Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
An ordained minister has decided to give up God for a year.
How the heck do you just up and become atheist after being a pastor?
What I'm most worried about right now is figuring out how I can live openly and honestly.
I am finally free to be me.
I have no idea how to find friends or become a part of a community that's not religious.
What does life look like after church, after religion, after God?
That's it in a nutshell.
This is the Life After God podcast, a conversation on the space between belief and unbelief and beyond, with your host, Ryan Bell.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Life After God podcast. This is Ryan Bell, I'm your host, and this is episode 29. And I've got a great interview for you today that I recorded a couple of weeks ago with my friend Mandisa Thomas, who is the founder and president of Black Nonbelievers. She lives in Atlanta, and I'll tell you a bit more about her in just a minute. But before I get to that, I can't let this opportunity go by to talk a little bit about feminism. I know this is a super uncontroversial topic that everybody just universally agrees about, so I thought, why not? I'll just talk a little bit about it today, because the day I'm recording this, today is Tuesday, March 8th. You might be listening to this on Wednesday, March 9th, or some point after that. But today, as I'm recording this, is International Women's Day, March 8th, 2016. And I was just thinking a little bit about women's issues. My girlfriend, Rebecca, hosts a feminist book club here in our apartment once a month. And a group of us get together and we've read a book or two in the last few months, and we discuss what we've read. Yesterday, we gathered and talked a little bit about Chimamanda Adichie's little book, We Should All Be Feminists. It's based on her TED Talk by the same name. And I first got to know Miss Adichie as a novelist. That's her main occupation. And she's written several fantastic novels, Purple Hibiscus, Half of a Yellow Sun, and most recently, Americana, which was one of my very favorite books that she's written. I got a chance to meet her a few years ago when she came to Los Angeles on the book tour for Americana. And I used to always show my undergraduate students in cultural studies her TED Talk, her other TED Talk that she's famous for, which is The Danger of a Single Story, which talks about prejudice and narratives and the way narratives embed within us stereotypes, and those stereotypes lead to prejudice. So check that out, The Danger of a Single Story. Anyway, that's a long way around to say that I've been thinking about women's issues a lot. And I tend to think a lot about issues of equality. For me, life after God means focusing less on what we don't have, namely the absence of a religion or the loss of a belief in God, and more on what we do have, the people around us, the relationships that we enjoy and cherish and need, and the community that we inhabit and the planet that we inhabit. These are the things that we know we have. And the after God period of our lives, those of us who have been religious in the past, consists primarily of these positive qualities, these positive attributes of what we do have in our life and less of what we don't have. And I think one of those issues that is so important for us to think about is the way in which inequality still dominates so many people and groups of people within our society and around the world. So this week on International Women's Day, I've been doing a little checking into the status of women around the world, just to check and see, you know, how the more than half of the world's population is faring. And here's what I found, and I won't read all of these because I don't want to take up too much time, and I know that you know how to read, and you can go to the link in the show notes and check them out for yourselves. This list comes from the website makers.com, and it's called 21 Facts You Never Knew About International Gender Inequality. Well, I don't know if you didn't know about them. Some of these you probably did know about. Some of them I did know about, but some of them I didn't have on the tip of my tongue. For instance, in 2015, only half of the world's working age women were in the workforce, compared to 77% of working age men. Women with full-time jobs still only earn about 77% of their male counterparts' earnings. That's one I think you've probably heard before, and it's sometimes disputed, but there is a great deal of evidence to show that in the United States, women earn about 77 cents on the dollar compared to men. Here's another one. African-American women earn 64 cents, and Latina women earn 56 cents for every dollar earned by a Caucasian man. So even worse for women of color. Let's see, what else? 62 million girls are denied an education all over the world. This is a huge, huge problem, of course. Here's another interesting one that often relates to religion. Every year, an estimated 15 million girls under age 18 are married worldwide, with little or no say in the matter. There's an organization called Girls Not Brides that studies the problem and is working to find a solution to this kind of problem. Another fact here, 4 out of 5 victims of human trafficking are girls. I'm sure that's no surprise to you. And let me see, what else do we have here? On average, 30% of women who have been in a relationship report that they have experienced some form of physical or sexual violence by their partner, intimate partner violence. 30% of women who have been in a relationship have experienced that. Female genital mutilation, something I'm sure you've heard about, affects more than 125 million girls and women alive today, and it is one of the main human rights violations that is being tracked by human rights organizations like Equality Now. Here's another one related to religion in certain parts of the world. At least 1,000 honor killings occur in India and Pakistan each year. Women around the world aged 15 to 44 are more at risk from rape and domestic violence than from cancer, car accidents, war, and malaria. This is a stat from the United Nations. Unbelievable. In 2018, there will be 1.4 million open technology jobs in the U.S. And at the current rate of students graduating with degrees in computer science, only 29% of applicants will be women. This is another huge problem. Women in the STEM fields is another form of inequality that we still experience, even in the developed world. So this list goes on and on. I think, you know, you've heard of many of these facts. And I hope that you will take a minute to do what you can in your sphere of influence to draw attention to these problems and to do what you can to combat them in your area of expertise or in your field. Before we leave this topic, another quick thing I discovered today. I was Googling about the status of women as it relates to religion, because I know in my gut, I have this feeling, right, that there's a relationship between religion and inequality. And it's not just a feeling. I've experienced it myself, maybe not personally because I'm a privileged man, but I've watched my sisters and people of color experience and LGBT people experience discrimination and bias primarily from religious folks, at least in the LGBT category. So I did a little Googling around to see if I could, you know, back up some of my hunches and my personal experiences with some data. And I ran across an article written by my friend Kyle Jones back in August of 2013. This was while I was still a pastor, and I didn't even know Kyle back in those days. It's on the Patheos website on the Emergent Village channel, or the Emergent Village blog, really under the Progressive Christian channel, honestly. 5 interesting facts about women and religion. I'll just tick these off really fast, and you can read more about them. I'll provide the link to this in the show notes. 1, women are more religious than men. He cites a U.S. Religious Landscape survey from 2009 put out by Pew showing that women tend to be more religious than men. Secondly, Catholic countries have an average 15% lower female labor participation than Protestant countries. Don't know much about that personally. Thirdly, religiosity contributes to more unequal gender outcomes. I think this is not surprising, but this is the one that most interests me in this on this topic. He ends this little section by saying, to put it bluntly, less religiosity means more equality for women. Fourthly, secular persons share the same voting patterns and values as women. In other words, women are more likely to vote in the same way secular people do for more equal outcomes for all people. So, International Women's Day, some information to fuel your imagination as you think about what it means to live life after God and to work to end inequality in all of its forms, and today focusing on inequality as it relates to the genders. And, you know, we still, in spite of all the advances we've made, we have a long ways to go in creating equal opportunities for women in our world, not just in developing parts of the world, but in the developed world as well, in the United States and Canada and Great Britain and Australia, New Zealand, around this topic. So do what you can do. Host a conversation. Step into a situation of inequality at work and advocate for someone who might be getting the short end of the stick, and do what you can to create more equality in our world. Next, I have for you this conversation that I had with Mandisa, who is a strong woman, a woman leader, a female leader in the Black community. She lives in Atlanta, Georgia. I first met her at the American Atheist Convention in 2014 while I was doing Year Without God. I met Jeremiah Kamara at that convention as well, who we mention in the show in just a minute, and several other leaders from Black Nonbelievers, which is the organization that Mandisa not only leads as president, but founded in 2011. Black Nonbelievers just celebrated their fifth anniversary, and some of the videos from that anniversary celebration can be found on their YouTube channel. I'll provide the link in the show notes and on our website. She's a partner, a parent, a leader, an intellectual, and someone who's been working at the intersection of secular life, atheism, humanism, and racial justice. So without any further comments from me at this point, I want to bring you this conversation with Mandisa Thomas. Mandisa Thomas, welcome to the Life After God podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's great to talk to you again. I think we talk from time to time, but it was great to see you at the Life After God launch party that we held there in Atlanta.
Yes.
And you spoke for us there at that event, and that was a lot of fun. As the founder of Black Nonbelievers, you guys just had your fifth anniversary, didn't you?
Yes, we did. We celebrated our fifth anniversary on January 16th in Atlanta.
Oh, that's so great. And I want to ask you more about that. But before I get into that, I wanted to just ask you a bit about your own story. A lot of what we do on this show is just find out from people who are involved in atheist and humanist movements, where they came from, you know, philosophically and religiously. And so I just wanted to start there, like with your personal story. Were you raised Christian in a church environment?
Actually, no. I am originally from New York City, and I was not formally raised religious in any way. And I was exposed to religion, Christianity in particular, and Islam to an extent. I was raised in what was called the conscious community, Black nationalism, which included a lot of learning about Black history and culture, and learning about systemic racism and injustice that have been committed against Blacks and other people of color and other marginalized communities. And so one of the things I learned very early on was how religion was basically forced upon us during American slavery. Pretty much it was forced in, throughout history, but on other people. But I learned in particular, as it pertains to Blacks in this country, about how Christianity was forced and how we seem to have accepted it, which never sat well with me growing up. And so And just kind of having sort of an outsider's view of how religion has really kind of taken a hold of the Black community.
Right.
It was something that I knew I would never come to accept, even though there were, you know, I have family members that are Christian. I have other family members that are Muslim. But for me, my mother really made a concerted effort to not have me and my brothers raised Christian in particular.
So your folks were part of the conscious community and sort of Black national movements. That's how you were first introduced to that movement, right? Like it was your parents?
Yes. I was born in the 70s, and that was a time of self-identification for many Blacks. There were right. many that were trying to connect to like their African roots and get a sense of identity through the history and culture. And so I grew up in a time period where it was very popular to name children African names and to have the children have a sense of identity as to, you know, the history that goes beyond what was being taught in schools.
Right.
And I would say that, my parents were kind of on that bandwagon. During that time. Me and my brothers were products of that.
Right. And so you've been, you know, relatively critical of religion from your very earliest days. I think that's a gift, you know. I don't think very many people I don't know as much about the Black community and Black families, but certainly in my family, you know, I was not taught to be critical of religion. I sort of had to figure that out on my own.
Yes, absolutely. And I definitely have seen, though, there is religion in the church in the Black community has just taken on such an interesting life of its own. It's like if you ever go to any Black church, it's definitely more entertaining. It's the music is probably, you know, better than you've ever, you know, that you've ever experienced in any other church or any other community. And so it can be a very lively part of the community and the sense of identity and culture as it pertains to the Black community. And so, which is why it can be interestingly more challenging to openly identify as a Black atheist or atheist in the Black community, because the church and religion is so interwoven into the identity of being Black that it's like you're separating yourself from just being Black if you're atheist.
Right.
So, it takes on that. It takes on that life of its own.
Wow,
and it
so
has.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I actually live in a really diverse neighborhood. Pasadena, California is pretty known for being a white bougie city, but I live in the most diverse neighborhood. A lot of Latino and Black families live immediately here, and across the street from me is a Black Pentecostal church. And when there's nice weather and I sit outside on a Sunday morning, I can hear the choir across the street, and it's so awesome. I mean, the music is so incredible. But I also get lots of knocks on the door from various groups wanting to tell me about Jesus. And,
right.
It's mostly not people from that church. It's usually Jehovah's Witnesses, which we apparently have a pretty strong contingent here in this neighborhood. But you know, when you're talking about the Black church, I was talking to Anthony Penn on the show about 2 weeks ago, and he was, in his new book, Humanism, he talks about how during civil rights, the Black church was in some respects, at least in some places, an advocate for racial equality and racial justice and changing the landscape in America and really putting their necks on the line to make a difference. And then in more modern times, it seems like, you know, according to what he's read and according to the people I've talked to and being a pastor myself for so many years, the Black church has kind of let go of that heritage in some sense and embraced a prosperity kind of gospel. Is that your take on it as well? Or
I would have to agree to an extent with his assessment. Really, the Black church, I think, has hijacked the legacy of the civil rights movement. According to some historians, there were many Black churches and pastors who you could rely on, pretty much like a handful of them, within that time period, because it was extremely dangerous to be outspoken.
Right.
It was extremely dangerous for, you know, many Blacks and allies to be open about protesting injustice, because it meant your life. And so I'm pretty sure that there were many ministers and many members of the clergy who were understandably concerned about their parishioners.
Right.
During that time period. And also too, looking back to the tradition of the church during slavery and during those times, the church really, I guess, it did really play a central role in the community. It was the place where Blacks could, you know, dress in their best, especially for those who were in, you know, domestic work. So it was a place of prosperity or a place where people could be, you know, promoted or idolized to an extent.
Right. Or thrive, at least, in that community.
Yes. And so really, I think once the crucial point of the civil rights movement ended, there left this space for, you know, for the beginning of the prosperity gospel, and the church to just really become sensationalized. Not that it wasn't before. I'm pretty sure that there are a lot of things that were probably swept under the rug, but it just really became, really the materialism of the Black church really, really started, I think, to hit its peak in the 80s.
Right. And not just the Black church. I mean, that's the era of Jimmy Swaggart.
Oh,
and,
yes.
Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. And I mean, the mega churches and the prosperity gospel was sweeping across Christianity, of all races, it seems to me.
Yes. And those churches really did have a lot of Black members too.
That's right.
So
yeah, that's right.
Notice. Yeah, they really, really did. And they really did appeal to the, you know, the evangelical movement, really appealed to the emotional sense of many people. And, you know, to me, it's very manipulative because, you know, you're taking advantage of people in their most vulnerable state.
Right. Well, I was just blown away when I saw Jeremiah Kamara's film Contradiction, and he really, and I know he's a friend of yours, and they're in Atlanta where you are, and I mean, I was just so grateful for that film, because, you know, here he was actually confronting ministers and people in the pews even, and saying, why are you participating in this? You know, why is there poverty so rampant in neighborhoods where there's a church on every corner? Can you explain this contradiction? And it's just a fascinating expose.
Yes, and I was so proud and honored to be a part of Contradiction.
Yeah.
And you know, I really don't make many excuses for the church as a support system, because now there's more money being poured into the institution collectively than what people are getting out of it. And so when people say, well, the church provides services and the church is a builds community, I can agree to an extent, but at what cost?
Right.
Because it seems like people it revolves around their entire life. And it really does seem to rob people of that sense of identity and that sense of self. And that is something that, you know, that's something that, you know, when you waste your time, or you feel like your time, well, when it seems like time is being wasted and money is being wasted, or that, you know, you have to give your last to the church, I have to question how really supportive this institution is.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, people are already on their last nickel half the time, and then to be expected, you know, that story in the Bible of the widow's mite, you know, gave the last coins that she had in her name, and that's celebrated. I mean, I remember as a child growing up in the church too, that being celebrated as a story of generosity and stewardship, you know, that we give to God the last penny that we have. And it's so manipulative in so many cases.
Right.
Well, take us back 5 years to the founding of of black non-believers. What was going on that made you and your colleagues decide this was the thing to do? And what's the charter of the organization? And what did you set out to do 5 years ago?
Oh, yes. What was going on at that time? There were a number of things that were taking place then. If you can recall, the 2010, the end of 2010 was the year that the Eddie Long scandal broke. Mm. The story of the bishop here in Atlanta, Eddie Long of New Birth Missionary Baptist in Lithonia, where it was reported that he was carrying on sexual relations with young men.
Oh, wow.
And yes, and there was a long history of cover up by the church. Also, too, what was taking place was that, I had met Jeremiah that year, Jeremiah Kamara, and I went to one of his book signings and one of his appearances. And what was interesting was that I actually had one of my mentors try to discourage me from being so, she questioned me about why no belief in God at all. Hmm. And she's a mentor to me because she actually encouraged me to be a thinker, a critical thinker.
Right.
And she's very, she's very adamant and passionate about issues that pertain to the black community. And certainly religion and the church is one. She really did have an issue with me being a non-believer and actually criticizing religion to the point where, we encourage people to get away from it.
Right.
And so that only fueled me, that only encouraged me to do it more because I had people contacting me saying that they thought they were the only ones. They thought that, they've had these thoughts about religion as well. And being here in Atlanta and starting to become involved with the secular community, I had talked to other black atheists online who had experienced some not so pleasant things when they attended predominantly white meetups.
Okay.
And so in me trying to get more involved and meet new people, I said, if we're all atheists, that I experienced exactly what other black atheists had experienced.
Okay.
When attending a predominantly white meetup in person.
Okay.
I thought I never met a black atheist before. And there was also this dismissal of what other atheists tend to go through if you aren't white. So me and my co-founder, I was telling him that there has to be more of us out here. You have this huge metropolitan city that has a lot of black folks here. Surely we aren't the only ones out here,
right?
But there's something that the meetups probably aren't doing to draw more out. So with my co-founder having a minister, he's a former minister as well, or he was at the time, but wanting to start an actual fellowship of people meeting in person and getting that support system offline, because, we knew without really knowing that there were others who were probably still sitting in churches. They're critical of this institution, but they don't know or have never seen anyone else like them.
Yeah.
And so
people think they're alone.
Right. And that others would not understand exactly what it is that we go through,
right,
within the black community. And so we knew that there was a need for us to form this organization to help bring out more of us.
Right.
And to help bridge those gaps with the secular community and in the black community. So that's where we started 5 years ago, was to really just to try to help bring more of us out, provide that support and put support that we knew that we could relate to coming from the black community.
So what now, I mean, what is, in those early days, what did an average meetup look like? Did you have like a speaker and time to just eat and talk with one another, or how did you go about it?
Well, we created a meetup page as well on meetup.com, and we built up the website. And from there, We just, our first meetup, there were about 14 of us there.
That's great for the first one.
Which is, yeah, absolutely. And what we, you know, it actually, our meetup started off what Sunday Assembly is now. Okay. We did a motivational reading. I actually sang, and because I have a musical background, but not having a church background, but knowing a lot of different songs and singing, you know, I would actually sing.
Right. That's awesome.
So, and then we would have discussions that related to everyday life as a non-believer. We did have, you know, different subject matters of how to deal with believers, practical things. And we still do that to this day. How to deal with the believers in the workplace, dating, you know, other, and then we also did have guest speakers. Jeremiah was our first, guest speaker that year. So we've always incorporated a number of activities within our events, and a lot of them were and still are social in nature. We go bowling sometimes, we go to the movies, we try to do different things that your normal everyday people do.
Right.
It's just that we're, you know, we've taken, many people have taken the church out of it. We've always been affiliated with Recovering From Religion since the beginning.
Okay.
And so we also facilitate a Recovering From Religion support meetup. So and our aim and our focus was always to encourage more open identification, to bring people together in fellowship, which I've been asked the question of before about fellowship. And like I was told years ago, that fellowship is not a religious word.
Right.
So, so yeah, that's what we do. We definitely try to bring people to, we bring people together, for support, networking, socialization, and as well as advocacy, now, because we are very pro LGBT, we are very pro human rights, we are very pro progressive measures and actions.
Okay.
And so we've incorporated all of that into our mission as an organization, as well as what we do. We've been able to provide platforms for people to express and tell their stories on film, because as our presence grew, so did the interest in hearing what we had to say.
Right.
So we've been able to get people to document their stories on film. And it's been an interesting process, because we've come across members, we've had members who were almost deathly afraid to speak on film at some point, because they weren't sure how their families were going to react, how it was going to affect their jobs, how it was going to affect their lives. But in providing that support and in connecting each other, there has been that growth where people have been able to deal with their situations a whole lot better as a result of being involved with us.
Right.
That makes sense. Being able to express that on film.
Yeah, I think
on camera,
it's much easier to have courage to tell your story when you're surrounded by people who support you and have a similar background.
Yes, absolutely.
When you feel alone and isolated, you don't want to really go out on a limb and say something that's super unpopular.
Exactly, and sometimes it only takes one. It only takes one person.
Right.
And in the middle, and with us participating with other secular organizations, getting and participating and attending other events, we were able to let people know, hey, this is, we're here, this is our organization, this is what we do, you know, we want to work with you, and this is, you know, we you know, very, very happy to, you know, to be there and to be out in the open, because even for those who can't, they know that there is that support system of people who can and who will. So that's been our, you know, our 5 years of just continuously doing that and building those relationships, fostering those connections, and just continuing to grow people on an individual basis, and also grow the organization.
Yeah, it's just slow, steady work, isn't it? You just have to stay at it and watch it slowly grow.
Yes, and sometimes it's difficult. Sometimes right. it is hard.
Well, we're dealing with people.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So you started with one meetup in Atlanta. Where are you at now? How many groups do you have around the country? Because I know it's become a national thing.
Yes, we broadened our scope to national after the Metro Orlando affiliate group was founded in November of late 2011, early 2012.
Okay,
because there was interest expressed in forming other groups in across the United States. And so we wanted to be that support system since Atlanta was the flagship group. We wanted to help, establish other groups in various cities for people who wanted to do the same. And we've always made sure that our platform is in-person participation. Mm. It is important that people see us in order for them to know that there is another organization, there is an organization that they can participate in, even if they aren't out. That became our core focus. That is our core focus, making sure that we are meeting people where they are. Hmm. Because it isn't always easy for people to find us. And one of the things that we knew had to change within the community was that we needed to reach out to people, not to proselytize, but to let people know that we were here and that we weren't going anywhere. Right. And also to put a very friendly spin on it as well, because many in the secular community, we aren't necessarily known for our social skills.
Hmm. That's true. That is true.
With all the online tension that takes place, and as well as how some people feel after leaving certain meetups. You know, some people feel like they don't want to go back because they don't think that they're welcome. We want everybody to know that they are welcome. Mm-hmm. To join us, and that again, the church doesn't have the monopoly on being welcoming and being friendly and tapping into that emotional side. It isn't manipulative, but for people to know that there are others who are going through the same thing.
Right.
That,
I mean,
that we have,
mm-hmm. You said something really, really important, which is trying to meet people where they're at. And I find this to be a simple concept to grasp, but a hard one for a lot of times for groups to enact, which, you know, because after you've been thinking about religion and theology and philosophy for a while, you become fairly convinced of your viewpoint. And, you know, I've met a lot of atheists online, especially, who are very convinced that they're right about many things, and perhaps they are right about many things. But when a person first begins to question their religion, when they first begin to suspect that something's not right, they're not quite ready for that onslaught of, well, if you have any sympathies towards the church, you're a bad person, or you haven't thought this through carefully, or you're not that smart, or so forth. So I love this idea of just welcoming people where they're at. They may not be where you're at. They may not be as convinced as you, but they're starting down a path and they feel lonely and they don't know where to go.
Right. And there are many ex-believers who are angry with their experiences and their encounters with the church. And we understand that.
Of course.
It is very understandable. So there are so many people who are just, they didn't come to atheism because they studied or they read all of these books by Richard Dawkins or any other scholar. There are many people who come to atheism and non-belief or questioning religion because they knew that something was wrong with it. And also with some of the experiences that they've had with either their pastors or other family members and friends. And sometimes they just need for people to say that they understand.
Right.
Because, you know, there are many things that people go through that are very emotionally draining and damaging. And And they've been, you know, they've been taught that, or they've been indoctrinated to think that, oh, well, if you just pray about it, then it'll go away. And which has unfortunately masked a lot of issues for many people. And so the first thing that they need to understand is that it is okay. It is okay to feel the way you feel. It is okay to have had these thoughts and have had these doubts, because we have all been there. Mm. And, you know, there are many people who go through that angry phase, and we get it.
Right.
We really do understand that.
Yeah, and you have to make room for that while trying not to alienate others who might be turned off by that anger. You know, it's a delicate balance, as you know. Like, it's very, very difficult. I moderate an online secret Facebook group for people that are sort of in the process of losing their faith. Some have already lost their faith and are just struggling to make sense of their lives in this post-God reality. And it's tough sometimes to balance the, you know, the desire to give people space to vent if they feel like they need to vent, and also give a safe environment for people that might be really turned off by that. So it's a challenge. I empathize with you.
Thank you. And what I try to do is, you know, I try to bring us to what we do have in common as well.
Right.
There are many, many, and I'm pretty sure that you you can relate to this. Religion isn't the only form of indoctrination that people have experienced.
That's right.
We say we're non-believers is that we go beyond the scope of just religion. We question and challenge anything that doesn't have a valid or verifiable premise.
Right.
We encourage an evidence-based mindset as well as an objective mindset, because there are many people who tend to get stuck in certain schools of thought because it is emotionally comforting to them.
Like, and what, for example?
There's a lot of, like, even with the spirituality and the, even when it comes to discussing matters that pertain to race.
Oh, right.
And when it comes to race as well as any other societal issues, that tends to be, that there's an emotional, it tends to be emotionally triggering.
Right.
And sometimes it's hard for people to, you know, to separate that.
Right. And really look at the evidence.
And right. And so sometimes even discussions about race get heated within the Black community.
Of course.
One thing I had to unlearn was this mindset that all Blacks had to think alike. Because I remember growing up, you know, thinking that, you know, we all had to be revolutionary, and that, you know, if you thought a certain way, then that, yeah, you were trying to be white, or that, you know, you're a sellout and you don't care about your community. But, you know, and so there were, and so I was indoctrinated as well. And so I had to realize that, you know, and I did learn this growing up, but I really had to come to understand that within the Black community, there is so much diversity.
Right.
There are so many schools of thought. We all don't have to think alike. We do tend to hold on to these traditional, I wouldn't even say values, but the church as an institution, there is an emotional tie to it that many people are afraid to let go of.
Sure.
When it comes to issues pertaining to, there are many Blacks who don't think that, you know, the LGBT issues pertain to them, and, okay, and they're totally wrong about that.
Right.
And so, so there's a lot in there, that there's a lot of misinformation that many still have. And there are these notions that, you know, of course, you know, atheism is a white thing. Only white people are atheists. You know, Blacks can't be atheists. So
you're like, but I'm right here in front of you.
That, you know, exactly. And so, you know, when we say that we do not readily subscribe to anything that cannot either be verified or, you know, or there is no evidence for, you know, that goes beyond religion. And because there are a lot of Black folks, even though they've dumped Christianity or they criticize it, they tend to hold on to other supernatural thoughts that are just as unverifiable.
Sure. Yeah.
And have no basis in evidence.
What have you, as you look back over 5 years, and you guys just had your anniversary celebration, you probably looked at some milestones during that celebration. I mean, what have you feel like you've been able to achieve in 5 years? And my other question is, how has the secular humanist atheist landscape changed in 5 years?
I think that we really have accomplished, there are many who credit encountering Black nonbelievers and me personally with their growth, with their ability to connect with other atheists. We actually have, We've actually seen people start families and start businesses through,
that's awesome,
through, connecting with our organization. And I've actually seen people grow and start, you know, and start, becoming more involved with the community. And they've actually started, you know, groups of their own. And there have been other speakers and authors and people with a tremendous amount of talent that have encountered us, and we've been able to help facilitate, you know, more exposure for them. Even Jeremiah says that some of his closest friends now have come as a result of, you know, being involved with Black nonbelievers. And so that is
that's
something that I know that we have. And also just the fact that, yes, we have had we were featured in the CBS Sunday Morning special last year about being openly secular. So we have had some major exposure, which has been awesome.
Right.
I would say the landscape of the secular community has changed in 5 years, in that now there are more women who are involved in the community. There are more people of color that are being featured at, you know, at your major conferences. Of course, now the groups that specifically focus on people of color, we're now putting on our own events.
Right.
And so, and we're doing it more often. And, so now we're able to, you know, we're getting the, you know, we're catching the eye of, you know, the other organizations and who are wanting to work with us, and we want to work with them too. So,
that's fantastic.
And then also not even just in, the number of women and people of color, the landscape of what has changed in the secular community is also the number of people who are, the people who are speaking, who have different experiences. And like you, for example, when you did the year as an atheist, and then, you know, with your experience and your encounters, how you're able to now tell your story, and how the stories aren't just coming from people who have these science backgrounds or these degrees. Now we're able to tell our stories coming from our communities, and also them with them being relatable to others. You know, that is also how in 5 years things have changed. You know, not just in what we look like, but what we have done and what our experiences are, and how we can connect with others and help the community grow.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I remember there were two television specials last year, and one was terribly white in its focus. There were no people of color featured really at all, except a friend of mine jokes that as the camera panned a church scene briefly, there was one person of color in the church. Like that was the extent. But then the CBS special, you know, that you talked about, really you had quite a few opportunities to speak in that, and that Black Nonbelievers was featured there, which was really great. I mean, I don't think the average middle American realizes that, you know, people of color, whether they be Black Americans or Latinos in America, the stereotype is that, you know, Latinos in the United States are largely Catholics, and Blacks in the United States are largely Baptist or some variation. And that's just how it is. Like, that's a monolith, you know. And so for people to start hearing these stories and to realize that there's diversity within diversity, you know, is really, really, I think, something that must have been an obvious shift in 5 years.
Yes, absolutely. And one thing that I try not to do is I don't play into the victim narrative or the downtrodden narrative.
Right.
Black history in itself the history of Blacks in this country has been one of resilience. It is one of diversity, and there are a lot of accomplishments. Our history doesn't just start with slavery and always struggling. And I think when you said earlier that Dr. Penn said that, you know, the church has lost that sense of history, and I agree that it has, because it tends to overlook many of accomplishments that Blacks have contributed to this country, and to just you know, to put that blanket as if it was, well, we've come this far through faith and through God is actually an insult to our history in this country. In fact, when we talk about Black History Month, which was started by Carter G. Woodson, or, you know, the Negro History Week, as it started out, he was a free thinker.
Right.
And an educator. So these are the types of stories that we need to keep alive. And it's important to all Americans that people have this knowledge and this information, and that free thinking and humanism and even atheism has been a presence within the Black community, even though it may not have been as strong, but it's getting stronger.
Right.
So
isn't it fair to say?
Isn't it
fair to say too that Frederick Douglass was a skeptic at the very least, if not an agnostic or an atheist? I mean, it seems to me, I recall in a few of his, I mean, and what a courageous man, you know, having been a freedman. I'm trying to think right now off the top of my head, I can't recall, but it seems that he had a few like pretty skeptical comments that he's famous for.
Yes. I think it was something about I prayed for years and then I received no answer until I prayed with my legs.
Right.
There is documentation that he was extremely critical of the church during his time.
And rightly so.
Absolutely.
The church was so involved in slavery and had no critique of it for a while until like a few Quakers and a few secular people and some feminist movements, you know, started saying, this is absurd. Like, how can we, you know, own another human being?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I think the church often gets a lot of credit for things that were also, you know, also helped along by humanism and secular people.
Yes. And that's why I said before that the church has hijacked that legacy.
Right.
Because actually, if you're, and this is one of the interesting things about the pathology of the Black community as far as it pertains to religion, because it became this sense of support and community for Blacks. But at the same time, the doctrine in itself, it did enslave us. And so there's very much a paradox when it comes to, you know, the pathology of it and the psychology of the suffering, which, you know, has over time proved very harmful. And so it's harmful to everyone.
Right.
But when you have people who were basically intentionally enslaved mentally by this religion, you know, you can't help but to wonder, you know, there's this interesting to say the least, this interesting paradigm when it comes to it. And so, you know, when people say stuff like, oh, well, we're all atheists, and why do you need to distinguish by saying you're Black atheist?
Right.
If you understand anything about the Black community, you would understand that, you know, there is a need for us to openly identify historically and currently, you know, so we're not just doing it because we want to feel special.
Right. Or exclusive or something.
Right. We did it because there was an actual need for it. You know, when I hear other Blacks tell me they've never met a Black atheist before, that's a problem to me.
Right.
That is a problem, period.
Sure. Yeah. And I think, you know, by and large, and again, I'm not blaming anybody necessarily, but as I go around and meet with different skeptical and free thought and atheist groups, it is by and large, you know, sort of middle-aged white people. And it's the outreach to communities of color and, you know, minority groups and groups that are in poverty, even white underclass people, you know, it's just not as present, in our conversations. And sometimes it takes new groups to raise that awareness and invite others into the conversation.
Right. Absolutely. And there are many humanists and atheists who basically have different passions and things that are of concern and of to them. And it is okay for us that as humanists and atheists, if we want to get involved with the community, it should be good for us to, it'll be good for us to do it as atheists and humanists. Now the apprehension of doing so with a highly religious community is completely understandable, which is why we do offer that support first, because it's almost impossible for us to go into these communities if we're still dealing with the trauma of overcoming religion. And so the different groups are needed for different things. The educational aspect, you know, the scientific aspect, the support aspect is all important to the community, because when you're dealing with people, you're dealing with different aspects of their lives. And I think as a community, as a secular community, as it grows, it's good for us to be better prepared to handle that. And so, and we don't have to do it all in one way. You know, there's many different ways that we can accomplish this. And I think it's important to be in understanding and embrace all of it.
Right. And I think it's also when you're someone like me who comes from the majority group in this country, you know, white, male, middle class, highly educated, all the, I used to tell my students, like, I check all the boxes, you know, like I have privilege in every single category. And I don't have, in order for me to understand the world, I need to hear stories from different perspectives, because otherwise I'm tempted to think that my viewpoint is the normative one, or that my experience of the world is the normative one. And I think, you know, each of our pathways into non-belief are a little bit different, even though there are some similar patterns to it and similar themes. I think, you know, a black family's experience of religion is going to be somewhat different than a white family's experience of religion. And we can learn from each other and really, build a more complete picture of the world if we have all these different perspectives, which is why I'm such a fan of what you're doing. And I just I'm so happy to be able to learn from what you guys are doing and support it to whatever little bit I can.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I really do appreciate the support that, you know, that we've received just from everyone who understands what it is that we're doing. And really, we are all in this together. You know, religion, I think, has, and the church has done a number on quite a few folks.
Right.
And it is important that, you know, we're able to help each other understand and support each other, no matter who we are.
Yeah, I mean, and our mission at Life After God is to create that sort of, like what Dr. Pinn says, like a soft landing place for people who are coming out of religion. That's what you're doing. That's what recovering from religion is doing. And so there's a number of us that are sort of trying to tackle this from a slightly different angle. And I think it's important for us to just back each other up, you know, I can't do the work you're doing and you can't necessarily do the work I'm doing, but we do it together and support one another. It doesn't have to be a competition.
Right. Absolutely. It does not. I agree.
Well, thanks so much. I know you have family and other responsibilities to get to tonight, and I don't want to keep you too long, but it's always a pleasure to talk to you. I don't know if there's any last thought you want to share before you go, or but it's just been a pleasure to talk to you. Maybe at least let us know where we can learn more about what you're up to.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You can always find us at our website at www.blacknonbelievers.org. And you can find us, we are on Twitter at Be Nonbelievers. We're on Meetup. We are a number of, and we're on Facebook as well. I try to post all of our appearances and events on our website calendar. There will be a more extensive write-up about the 5th anniversary celebration on there soon.
Awesome.
I just uploaded the workshop panels that we offered there.
Oh, cool.
We had a number of them. We tackled three very distinctive subjects that I'm very, very proud to have featured. Hmm. And so, just definitely visit our website to find out more about us, as well as some of the organizations that we are affiliated with, as well as the events that are coming up. We are one of the sponsors for the upcoming Reason Rally in June, and we're excited about that.
Okay, great.
And we hope you all come out.
Awesome. So blacknonbelievers.org, go there and check out the work that Mandisa and her team are doing. And what cities do you have meetups in? I know there's one in Detroit. Is that right?
Yes, in Detroit, of course, Atlanta, Orlando, Dallas, D.C. Those are the most active groups. We do have affiliates in Memphis, and one in Louisville as well, okay. Charlotte, North Carolina. And so, our website has a listing of all of the affiliate in Chicago as well.
Oh, that's great. So there's a lot. What a lot of growth you've seen in 5 years. Well, it's so great. And thank you for, I know it's sometimes thankless, tiring work, but thank you for everything that you're doing and for, you know, sharing with our, you know, my listeners for a few minutes here about your work. And I'm going to wish you all the best in the next 5 years to come.
Thank you so very much. And I look forward to seeing you again soon, Ryan.
I'm so grateful for the work that Mandisa is doing in Atlanta and around the country to create communities for, especially for Black non-believers, people perhaps who have been believers and aren't anymore, or perhaps African Americans who have never been religious and just feel that they don't fit in their community where the majority are believers. I'm just honored to know her and grateful for her time in sharing a little bit about her story and the history of Black non-believers. I'll put a bunch of stuff in the show notes where you can find out more about her and her organization. Obviously, the website, Black Non-Believers, and also a link to the CBS special that aired last year in which Mandisa was featured. And she spoke a bit about African Americans and atheism, especially in the American South. And so I hope you'll check that out. And then also their YouTube channel, where some videos are posted from the 5-year anniversary celebration that they just had. So I hope you check those things out and find out a little bit more about her. Support their work as you are able. And I just look forward to any future collaborations that she and I can come up with for Life After God and Black Nonbelievers. They're doing great work. I also mentioned in my conversation with Mandisa a documentary directed and produced by Jeremiah Kamara called Contradiction. And I'll also provide the link to that film in the show notes. I really recommend you checking that out. And I just spoke to Jeremiah on the phone not too long ago, and he, like most artists and creatives, is working on another project. So I hope you'll stay tuned with the work that Jeremiah is doing on this topic as well. But Contradiction really does look more closely at this contradiction between the prevalence of African-American churches, especially in urban areas, alongside really debilitating poverty. And how can these two things coexist together? What's really going on in that dynamic? So I'll link to Jeremiah's movie, and I hope you'll check that out as well. Well, thanks again for tuning in with us this week. I hope you've appreciated this episode. Please visit our website, lifeaftergod.org, for more information about the work we do at Life After God. It isn't just the podcast. We do personal coaching. There's a secret Facebook page for peer support. We're going to be holding some events and activities during the remainder of this year. There are cohorts developing in different parts of the country, and just a lot of good stuff coming down the line. So check us out at lifeaftergod.org. Follow us on social media. All the links are there. And if you're able to support the work we're doing by making a contribution, please visit my Patreon page at patreon.com/lifeaftergod. And you can make a monthly recurring donation of any size at that site. And I'm so grateful for those of you who have been doing that for so long. Thank you for your support. Without you, this literally would not be possible. And again, thanks so much for all that you do. Until next time, my name is Ryan Bell, and this has been Life After God.
With
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.